SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online, and at our website, stevebick.com, as well. Lots of, very interesting things to talk about today. We've got a pretty full dance card, and I guess first and foremost, before I even lay out the lineup and what we're going to do today, the first order of business, of course, is the passing of Fusaichi Pegasus. And that is going to actually set the tone for a good portion of the discussions. And the most interesting part, I mean, other than his great career, albeit, you know, somewhat incomplete. I don't think is that an unfair way to identify Fupeg's, right? Is that, I mean, not every horse has the opportunity to, you know, to run as a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old and, you know, accumulate a complete resume. But, you know, there's obviously, you know, horses that at any point can prove their mettle, and then some. And he won 6 of 9 and continues to be, actually, the most expensive purchase at auction to win the Derby. And that topic is going to be, I think, well fleshed out this morning, because Alan Carrasco, and I don't know if Alan realized, you know, what he was about to set off when when he posted yesterday the Wednesday morning edition of the Thoroughbred Daily News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 1998. Travel back with us now. an unbelievable, I mean remarkable, tally sheet of the 3-day July sale. This was when Keeneland was running a July sale for yearlings. And 3 days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and the Tuesday session, produced, I think he was maybe the second to last or third last yearling through the ring, was Fupeg, Mr. Prospector, out of Angel Fever, and $4 million to Mr. Sekiguchi in a spirited bidding battle. And we will go back for that, because Satish Sanand is going to join us at 10 o'clock. I could not resist. Satish and his upstart Padua Stables, those 3 nights at Keeneland, part of a season-long yearling buying spree of over $30 million, but on those 3 sessions, Satish brought home 14 yearlings, $13,350,000. And he's going to tell you he wanted Fupeg and he would have gone higher. And he had a partner potentially, or a partner actively involved. I'm not going to take away from the what'll be a very fun recounting of that night. But what's amazing is when you go through the sale, and I mean, just in that night alone, Satish brought home, amazingly, five hips apart, brought home exchange rate and cash run. Yeah. Coolmore was out of control at this sale as well. And they figure into this story. It is a dizzying. And I mean, I'm not as expert on sales coverage. I suppose Glennie Kane Oakford would be useful for this discussion, frankly, because I guarantee you she was in the press gallery covering this, and it is as amazing a one night slate of yearlings that, you know, were distributed as you're ever going to see. And I think, you know, one name that didn't show up just because on this tally sheet and the page that Alan put up on Twitter, the five Colts, the lowest price Colt was $1 million. And there was more than just the Danzig that was hip 200. The last 20 hips were give or take, were insane. In terms of what they ended up being, and it's alphabetical. That's the funny part about it. That in a lot of cases, you know, you see the letters at the end of the sale that night. It was the dams were all A's, including Angel Fever. That's not like you know, the yearling version of Fupeg was an unknown quantity. He was very much the anticipated sale topper. But when you see what else went through the ring that night, it'll curl your hair. It's the one that is missed, that because he only sold only for $450,000. The Nureyev Colt out of Mr. P's Princess, Harold Harrison, I think, bred, and Dixiana consigned, and Demi O'Byrne bought Vasilyev. Yeah, and so for all of the glittering names that came out of this, maybe about 15 hips later, they also got Monashi Mountain. The Danzig out of Prospector's Delight, he was $1 million. He's in the top five. The top five Colts that night. Fusaichi Pegasus, videograph for Satish, exchange rate for Satish, true confidence for Satish, and Monashi Mountain for Coolmore. And on the Philly side, Satish paid the top price for the Seeking the Gold Philly out of Shared Interest that Shell Evans bred. This would be cash run, $1.2 million. Then there was the Sunday Silence that Oak Horse Farm Corp bought. Silence Beauty, the half to Sky Beauty. And as Nick Tamaro actually jumped on. Everybody, it's funny, it just shows you how different, how interesting people find the breeding side and the sales side. And I talk often about how much fun, you know, there's so many different places to, you know, take an interest in the game. And, you know, this is one of them. And so everybody looked at this and they were brought back to that day. And there's some wonderful, I mean, there's not an extensive list of comments, but there's some fun ones. And, you know, some Polo Green and Tom Ryan and Melissa Nolan, who I think, I don't know if she was working at Padua at the time, but she did come to probably around that time, maybe a little after that. Craig Burnick, Craig Burnett got a kick out of the fact that TDN was $2. That was he focused in on that. I'm trying to find where Nick mentioned about Silence Beauty. Anyway, the first thing I did when this popped up, I sent it to Satish. I said, "Do you want to?" He said, "I could come on at 10 tomorrow." I said, "All right, it's a deal." And so, you know, in addition to kind of reliving the night a little bit, I want Satish to talk because it's been a number of years since we've had this kind of conversation. And you know, with the two-year-old and training season drawing closer to a close, we still have the June sale at OBS and the new Phasig June. But, you know, the yearling market, you know, the yearling catalogs are going out soon enough, you know, July, and then we'll focus at Saratoga, etc. So I want Satish to talk about what the philosophy was, the approach, what the thinking was, the budget, and you know, very well, I think, if you know Satish's story, that I mean, his goal, like so many that get involved in the game at this level, was a derby. I mean, he wanted to win derby. Instead, he managed to win, you know, just about everything else. Like reminds me of the great Star Trek moment when Kirk is stuck in the Genesis planet and he says up to Monoban, to Khan, "You've managed to kill everyone else, but like the poor marksman you are, you missed the mark." Well, Satish, you know, tried to get a derby. Instead, he won a bunch of Breeders' Cup races, and he, you know, he was a part of Curlin's success and more. So he had plenty of success. And so I'm curious. I mean, his view now from, you know, from 10,000 feet, as it were, you know, looking back and you know, what cautionary tales there are. when I tweeted about what Satish spent that yearling season in 1998, the $34 million, our man Freddie Moe called it a flesh wound. not inaccurately either. So I think this will be a lot of fun. And you know, for those that listen, you have to have means to wade into this marketplace. But you know, and I think to some degree that portion of the discussion gives rise to what we see now in terms of the groupings of owners, you know, spreading out the expense. And you know, you only have to look at Saturday, frankly. And I know a lot of people are put off by the phone book of, you know, ownership that is involved in some of these horses, and you know, National Treasure, an example. But it's a mixed bag. It's not as, to me, it's not as big of a problem as some people want to make it out to be, and it's not a positive either entirely. But I mean, frankly, this, I guess I can draw a parallel somewhat to that aspect, to what we discussed yesterday with Tom Lute. And I hope that, you know, some of the people who were quick to just out of hand, without any real, you know, fleshing out of the National Thoroughbred League concept, I hope that, you know, some were, you know, had their glasses cleaned, as they say, by Tom Lute, you know, expressing and kind of expanding on some of the less complete aspects of the reporting about the league concept. And I hope that that's the case. I saw, you know, further bashing of the concept yesterday. But if you heard Tom, I hope would say, well, all right, let's see how they do it. And you can also tell that I would think that if you read the names involved, you'll understand that this is a well-financed concept. This is not being done on a shoestring. So anyway, but it has some of the elements, the agglomeration of and concentration of personalities and individuals to create a collective positive result. That's the to me, that seems like a parallel to the groupings of sale candidates to some degree. So anyway, this should be fun. Having Satish is fun. Just listening to him is fun. So I'm looking forward to it. 10 o'clock for Satish. In this hour yet, we've got a visit with Chris Murs. We'll go to Shakopee, where they're facing some challenges. There's no pussyfooting around the situation at Canterbury. The 10-year agreement with the tribe, with Mystic Lake, could not be renewed, and the purses are taking a hit, but they will do what they can. And Chris is an outstanding racing office manager, executive with plenty of experience, and he'll talk about how he's going to approach the season. Certainly, for those in the Twin Cities, I thought I did a decent Howard Cosell with the National Thoroughbred League. I don't know if I can I do a Ted Baxter? I don't know if I can. We need. I think we do need Frank. I think I got to put out the bat signal for Frank, if we're going to do some reporting from the Twin Cities. We'll talk about their season that opens this weekend. They've got the pair of Minnesota bred stakes to get going, and looking forward to talking to Chris. In fact, we got a pair of Chris's. Chris Hyde is going to join us, the animal lobbyist, and we're gonna get geared up again and try to get a SAFE Act through the halls of Congress. This has been maddening, fighting certain. Certain interests that have managed to sink efforts, especially on this topic, when it seemed like most recently the last year's attempt seemed to have real momentum and real potential. So Chris will update us on the new initiative. And I'm also expecting to get a visit in, albeit it'll be quick because they always are, with Uncle Neil Drysdale, to talk about FUPEG and the experience that he had with him. And I wrote yesterday, above the, when I retweeted the news of his passing, he really felt like one of the horses in that era. You know, we had so many prominent horses, whether it was Triple Crown tries or, you know, Triple Crown upsetters or, you know, that period. He felt like a, you know, like a touchstone type horse. And that, you know, that drew people into the game. I mean, the hype, I remember the hype being extensive. And I was, you know, a fairly, you know, I was an active fan and at that point in player. And actually, from a Derby standpoint, that probably was one of the Derbies that, you know, that was starting to get, you know, really involved and interested. And part of it was the move to Saratoga, and actually signing on with Barry and Bill for the Carolina Barbecue. Right then, 99 is when I moved here. So I personally don't know how why does this happen to me. I was not a Fupe guy, and I don't mind admitting that. They all can't, you know, yeah, that's part of it. He was, you know, he was going to go favored, and there were a couple of horses that I can recall. You know, from that, you know, from that Derby crop, and it's amazing how many yearlings, by the way, I'm sure this will come up too, how many yearlings in that sale in 98 made it to the Derby. Fupeg, Exchange Rate himself, actually, and I mean, obviously, Exchange Rate had no business. I forgot that Calvin Burrell rode him. Exchange Rate was not going to be a, you know, a mile and a quarter horse. High Yield came out of that sale. Commendable came out of that sale. Graham Hall came out of that sale. Unbelievable. There's probably more, actually. I remember liking Impeachment. Maybe because Perrette was riding. I'm not sure, but. This, of course, you've heard Mig talk about it, and I watched the replay. You know, Mig was on Wheel Away and has the lead in between points of call at the top of the stretch and settled for fifth. Fusaichi Pegasus, Aptitude, and Impeachment was third, and was it Aptitude that came up the rail? I think it was Aptitude that came scooting up the rail. Or it might have been Impeachment because he came from way back. How about More Than Ready was fourth in that Derby? And interestingly, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of the year in the Breeders' Cup in 2000, he was fourth in the sprint. Showing you, you know, the kind of interesting horse that he was, and by all rights, he was a turf horse. More Than Ready. It's kind of funny. Yeah, with Johnny. What was he? 11-1. 11-1. Fupeg, Aptitude, Impeachment, More Than Ready, Wheel Away, China Visit, with the Tory. forgot about him. Carule. Marlon St. Julian aboard. Captain Steve, War Chant, turf horse, who in that Breeders' Cup at Churchill would hang one of the toughest defeats on the backers of Northeast Bound that has ever been. And Bill Perry, that was tough. Speaking of Neil Drysdale, Deputy Warlock with Guidry. Trippy. There's a horse who had no business being in the Derby. Right? We talk about horses these days, they went 22-2, 45-4, 109-4. That's what happens when you've got when you've got Trippi in the field and similar kinds of sprinty types, right? Yeah, who was in front early? Trippi was second early, and Hal's Hope. Oh my God, Hal's Hope. That's right. With Roger Velez, unbelievable. Anyway. I knew that I would go careening off with this topic because it's a fun topic and interesting. So, Fu Peg, one of KD's three, Kent DeSormo's one of his three Derby wins. And you know, after he won, right, after he won, there was that long stretch of with no favorites. Isn't that right? I think so. If I'm not mistaken, he was the last favorite for, and then we had a run. Then we had a crazy run of favorites that seems to coincide with the change to the point, the introduction of the point system. So should be fun. All right, I exactly. I went into a deep dive. Into this. So, later, we have to get to Seth. I can't miss Seth Barrow again today. And Rich Eng is overdue, as well. We being on the road is tough because, you know, you get pop-up guests, you know, like, you know, the way a food truck shows up. I think Tom Law is supposed to join us too, and let me make sure that Law is since that I'm gonna make sure he's alive and kicking. All right, and 11 o'clock. Don't forget Thorograph conversation. Jeff Franklin will be here. And if you haven't signed up, go to Thorograph now. And by the way, Jerry posted the Preakness Day. He didn't put Black Eyed Susan up. I wish he had. I'll ask him maybe to do that. But the Preakness Day figures are up in the Red Board Room. As the race of the week. We'll go if you do the drop-down menu, you'll find race of the week and go there. And the Preakness figs are up. It's very interesting. And, I mean, predictably, Blazing Sevens got the best figure in the Preakness by a wide margin, having lost as much ground as he did. So I'll let you explore that, and maybe Jeff and I will touch on it. But the races that Jeff and I are going to do, the 6th and 7th for Saturday at Santa Anita, and the nice card at Santa Anita on Saturday. Look forward to it tomorrow, doing some work with Hammer. There are back-to-back stakes, the Daytona and the Triple Bend, but I did actually a dirt mile allowance. The 6th race is a very good dirt mile allowance, and then the Daytona coming down the hill. So those are the two races we'll do, and there's plenty of time. Go sign up. You'll see the little green box in the upper right-hand corner, thoroughgraph.com. Click where it says click here. Provide your email address, and the file will be instantly sent to you with the sheets. And we're trying to help you learn how to understand sheet methodology. And you can take part in this as much as you want. And when you're comfortable, try it for yourself. So it, to me, it's invaluable. Can't be beat. So, Chris Hyde, Chris Mers, Satish, Tom Law, Crafty Jeff, Seth, and Rich Eng. Tom Law is a confirmed, by the way, for those of you that were worried. Let me get to Chris Hyde, and we'll get the strategy and help everybody line up their support. And we'll find out how to try to make this happen yet again this year. Chris Hyde, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I don't want to pull out Lucy and the football, but it's tough not to. How are we going to do this? Let's get this thing accomplished.
Yeah, it's still going to be the same fight, you know, that we've had. But you know, I think I've said before, you know, the way to often move legislation, you know, unless it's kind of these big signature bills on anything, is to try to attach them to larger bills that must pass. And you know, for some time we've thought about, there's a bill called the Farm Bill that Congress does and reauthorizes every 5 years, which just includes, I won't go down that path, there's a lot of money going into this thing, you know, to support agriculture and issues like that in the United States. So, you know, we've thought some time about using that as a vehicle to try to move horse slaughter, because obviously it's an agricultural issue and food safety and things. But you know, the concern in the past had always been with this bill that it is really completely written behind closed doors. Well, now there's a dog. It's completely written behind closed doors. So you don't have much say in what gets in or what can happen to the bill that you're working on. But we thought we have to try it. You know, as you said with the Lucy, you know, this is 21 years we've been working on this bill. So it's, you know, we had to find something, you know, to try to move it. And so this was a vehicle that's coming up and they're working on. So that's kind of the approach that we took with this one.
Explain the subterfuge or the submarining of prior efforts, and what can shield this now or any time in the future. The reason I'm asking this, Chris Hyde with us, the animal lobbyist, as we talk about trying to get the SAFE Act, which could put a permanent end to the export of domestic horses for slaughter. Could put an end to it for good. And I think about what the NTRA did when they shifted focus, when the Alpine Group and our late friend Greg Means, when they said, you know what, let's stop trying to do this in Congress, and they went to Treasury. And they got the underpinning change, the actual rule affecting gambling winnings. They got it changed that way, and it was an incredibly clever, you know, exit ramp essentially to conflict and to trying to explain how, you know, giving more money back to horse players would result in more tax revenue. You know, because we got people who obviously, you got people in Congress these days that are incredibly thick. Explaining it, I could just picture her trying to explain the concept of churn to, you know, to these, you know, the Congress critters. is there an alternative way? I mean, obviously, we stopped slaughter in the U.S. by the USDA ending funding for inspectors, meat inspectors. So slaughter ended, you know, within our borders. Do I have any chance of finding a suitable alternative approach to this?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously that's something that's why we've had different versions of this bill to try to find how to get it, you know, not all ideal. Obviously the first one was kind of the ideal bill. It was a pure outright ban through the Department of Agriculture, no questions, just a straight ban. You know, and then that didn't work, so we tried to criminalize it. We've talked about the food safety. So, you know, so we've looked at legislatively every route. We have tried with the White House as well. Some years ago, you know, we met with during the Bush administration, went back that far, that we worked with him and we talked about this. It's like, why are we spending $5 million tax dollars a year to inspect these foreign-owned slaughterhouses? And they pay no taxes in the United States. So they operate at a loss here just so they can make it all up overseas again. And we're paying for it. The only hard part we've run into in getting anybody's ultimate support is we can then run into the livestock industry, which so dominates. So, we're actually running into, an industry where I think with the racing issue you brought up didn't necessarily run into. That was more just lack of will and interest in doing it. This one is we're running into an industry that's really heavily controls Congress, with everything that they do. So, when they said no and they give just subtle, hints to saying no, there's no incentive for legislators to do anything, because they do animal issues because it's a feel-good thing to them. They don't see it, as the right thing to do or that it can save money or all these kinds of things. They're just kind of locked into it. Well, we'll do it if it's a feel good and it doesn't conflict with anything. So that's often, kind of the hurdle that we run into, which is why we formed that PAC, the National Horse Protection PAC, is specifically to work on and raise the level and support for animal issues to show that they are things that you can go, vote for, if it's a good animal legislator, regardless of the party, then they can be good. So there's it's kind of a roundabout way to your point with that. But yeah, we're always looking for options to try to get it and get the president to do it, just get USDA to do it. But they just haven't had the will or the interest to do it at this point. So that's the frustrating thing we continue to run into.
This effort, it'll be a conventional approach. How do we get behind it? What does the rank and file need to do to assist?
Well, I think it's hard that we're kind of beating the same thing. This is going to be as tough. I'll be very honest. I was very nervous about this route, which is we've explored it in the past. To stick it in this, because as I said, basically you're handing off your language to the very people that have done everything they can to undermine it for the last 20 years, the Ag Committee. That doesn't mean we can't do it because we do have some friendly people on the committee. But you basically are handing this off to them. So I'm very nervous coming out of the other side of the slaughter on tribal lands and reservations. Then we'd have to fight to kill the bill. The public really needs to step up. Major leaders in the racing industry really need to step up. It's been getting better. But, as I said before, those are often the people that Congress is going to listen to, business owners and, large investors and supporters of theirs. That tends to get their attention more than, kind of the average public interest. But we have to ramp them up both, to new levels that we haven't seen before. It's going to be tough. But, I think with the Farm Bill, we can get it done because they have to pass it. We just need to make sure we're in it and clean.
Interesting. Who are our friends that are on the front line of this?
Well, we've gotten back Vern Buchanan, who is a Republican from Florida, who is the lead sponsor. Jan Schakowsky is the lead Democratic sponsor in the House. We're getting ready to have it reintroduced from Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey, and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina are going to get ready to reintroduce it. We've got great legislators like Senator Cory Booker is on the Ag Committee.
Nice.
I know he's going to, try to help. We've got some good ones from California. Jimmy Panetta, will help and be supportive. So we've got them out there, and you can, anybody that's listening can go to returntofreedom.org and, they're getting the link up because this bill's new. They're just getting it up, but you can go there and find telephone numbers to contact your legislators. And I would encourage everybody to go look at the makeup, the membership of the House Agriculture Committee and the Senate Agriculture Committee. And especially if any of their legislators serve on those committees, those are the people that really need to hear because they're going to be crafting and working the Farm Bill behind the scenes. So we really need to make sure, those are heard. And if anybody knows anybody, reach out and find me, because always looking for direct connections to members of Congress and committee members so we can get them even more engaged is extremely important.
Wouldn't this is the first full opportunity, I imagine, for Tom Rooney to get involved in this, correct?
Yeah, and I would hope if you or anybody listening, we still have not, that I've gotten or seen, you know, because we have been working. We did a coalition with the Jockey Club and others to do called the Final Stretch to get this thing done with some of the large welfare groups, horse welfare groups. And we can't get the NTRA to join on to that and support in that, so we'd love to get them. And I know he's been supportive in the past. I actually worked with him in Connie Mack's office, Senator Connie Mack of Florida, when he was a staffer many years ago. So, you know, and I know he's supported the ban on slaughter in the past, so we just really need to get him, you know, involved with the rest of the racing industry and send a message. Because, you know, we've got Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, has always been supportive of this. So that's certainly a great help, and that's a great help with the racing industry, you know, to continue to get to him to say, you know, we got the drug racing bill done last cut. Let's get this one done. This is even easier than that. You know, there's nobody, you know, impacted by this other than bad players. So, you know, that's another good route to go.
Yeah, on that topic, what's the prospect of criminal? I don't know if criminalize is the right word, but in terms of the slaughter pipeline, which we haven't, mm-hmm. we really haven't talked about, you know, part of past efforts have included, you know, the criminalizing the transport, right, of horses. That, you know, that's a key component. What about the kill pens? What can be done to stop them? Are they licensed? They've got to be licensed, correct? As a livestock purveyor?
Yeah, they are registered to do that kind of stuff. I mean, and that's, I mean, that's a whole other fight. I mean, I've got other animal clients that we are constantly fighting with the USDA to get them to enforce, you know, basic oversight of, you know, of the livestock industry and things and welfare. So, I mean, that's been, you know, a funding and very difficult issue to get that involved and get that shut down. So, but, you know, if you get rid of the slaughter part, they wouldn't be keeping them in feedlots. There wouldn't be that sense and need for it because there wouldn't be a market for them to go anywhere. I mean, you still have auctions in those natures where they're collecting the horses and things, but that's not uncommon. I mean, those I go to those and have gone to those since I was a kid in central Ohio, Sugar Creek, which is one of the large auction houses that was sending horses to slaughter in the Amish country.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, the original bill was ideal. The rest have not been as, you know, but again, we're going at a problem that, you know, we're hoping. Because, you know, as much as I dislike the kill buyers and those kinds of things, they do other, well, this is even legal, as much as I dislike it, but they're doing other businesses. They're hauling livestock, you know, cattle and things like that. So, you know, are they going to risk ruining their actual career or livelihood, you know, to try to subvert this industry? Because it's not a drug running industry. It's not an animal fighting industry. So it's not, you know, one of those that they're doing kind of for entertainment behind the scenes. So, you know, the hope is that if you at least clamp it down, that's going to scare everybody that they're just not even going to attempt to do it because it's just not worth it.
Well,
and too hard.
Yeah. Making this happen, the names you're including, you would think that you've got enough powerful types. I mean, yeah.
It's just the ultimate will. You know, I think, you know, I said before, the last time we came really close is when we had, it was a John Hettinger, who used to own Fasig Tipton.
Yes.
You know, a great New York horse owner, you know, was just a beautiful, beautiful person. And he just, you know, he had all the connections and these guys would listen to him, you know, and because he was a serious horse owner and he wanted to do the right thing. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I've been looking for since John passed. So, you know, because he really could shake things up. And that's what we need in moving it forward, ultimately.
All right, I've got a couple of. I'm glad we went in this direction, and we'll talk off air too. We'll see if we can't come up with some other ideas.
Well, I appreciate you. We're getting all that stuff up, like the Senate, you know, on the website returntofreedom.org, and then the Senate bill will be out next week, and which is good. Then we'll have two identical versions of the bill that we can work. So I think this could be it. This is going to be the real street fight, but this could be it because everything has to move. So that's our ultimate hope, is that they have to do it. So we'll see.
All right.
They don't have to do our bill necessarily, but they have to move the farm bill.
Yeah, farm
and that
bill.
Gives us something that we can be a part of. Yeah.
Certainly people involved in the industry have successfully tacked legislation onto other bigger bills. They most notably the mechanism that went into full practice on Monday. So
yeah,
they
absolutely won. Yes, and that was McConnell.
Yeah, you know, that's
so
right.
That's
how about
the kind
that?
Of stuff that can be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So that's our hope. That's what, getting the message to him and finding people to say, okay, enough's enough. And that's my point. Just enough's enough. I'm sick of hearing this issue every year. And again, who does it impact? At least with the racing, drug racing issue, that actually had a big impact, on various sides. And so horse slaughter's like, well, who are we defending by protecting this industry? Other than they just don't want to ban a meat animal, really, the livestock industry. That's their argument. They think slippery slope. Which is, nonsense.
Which is
but
preposterous.
That's, it works.
Yeah, well.
Simple minds, attract to those ideas.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that you got an open forum here, and whatever we need to do to keep this ball in the air and have it top of mind for people, just let me know, and we'll just keep.
No, I appreciate it, and we've got to pound away, because as soon as we don't, it'll be back here in a large scale. I know it. That's the scary part.
Yeah.
So that's something we just can't give up. It's just any single opportunity. If anybody has any great ideas, let me know. Because I'm open to anything to try to get this thing done.
Well, and let's remind everybody of all the points of contact and the germane support systems, including. Obviously, your agency, but Return to Freedom as well.
Yeah, I think that's the best thing to go is to go to returntofreedom.org, and they'll have, on the front, they're putting up right now today, there's already fact sheets and the telephone number that you can call Congress directly, 202-225-3121, and just ask to be connected to your member of Congress, and they'll help you if you're not quite sure who it is. They'll connect you and then talk to them, urge them to support the SAFE Act, which was just reintroduced by Congressman Vern Buchanan and Jan Schakowsky. And we just added a bunch of co-sponsors today to the bill, so they're going to start coming on. And then you may have to help me. I actually don't remember my own Twitter accounts.
It's the animal, your animal lobbyist, right?
Animal lobbyist, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I was like, I haven't tweeted myself in a while.
Animal.
To see what I've done.
Yeah. Return to Freedom is one that you should be following, and
yes,
they're California based, and there's a lot more beyond this effort. Return to Freedom is involved with with the herd management and with the BLM nonsense. Talk about an awful
that's another mess
situation with the Mustang herds and the correct way to manage their population. One of my favorites, donkeys. We love the donkeys, and you'd be surprised how much peril donkeys are in all the time.
Oh yeah, they collect their skins and use their skins for medicinal purposes and all that kind of stuff. So everybody's facing troubles.
Yeah, that's
which is why we put equine in this bill. Actually, I had some activists mad at me that we amended this bill to only say cats, dogs, and equines. She's like, oh, who cares about donkeys and mules? Let's just put in horses. And I'm like, oh, I care about all those. Well, because they're all being dragged into this industry. And they're used for dog meat more than horses would be. So I tell you, you can't please an activist on the internet, but you keep trying.
Well put. Chris Hyde, everybody. Animal Lobbyist is Chris's address, and he's gonna put the spurs to his tweeting, and returntofreedom.org as well as Return to Freedom to keep tabs, and we're gonna come up with some We're going to come up with some pressure points, I think, that we can think of. And for those of you that are involved in any kind of lobbying efforts, I should reach out to Bacik, see what the champ can do. We'll any help that anybody thinks they can offer, step up, and we'll see if we can't get this thing over the goal line.
Absolutely. That's what we need. I mean, that's what they're afraid of. If we could actually all organize, and we've gotten better. Last year was good, and I think if we can all organize and just push it, and, you know, the Farm Bill is the vehicle to do it. So
excellent.
I think we're there. We're going to just put the foot on the gas pedal.
Chris Hyde, everybody. Heyde. Give your email too, Chris.
The email is Cheyde, my first initial and last name, at bluemarblestrategy.com. And it's all one word, bluemarblestrategy.com. And that's also my website. But
exactly.
It's fairly static, but it's there.
Very good. Chris, thank you.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Not at all.
Bye.
Chris Hyde, and we're going to do this again, and we'll figure out how to pull this together. Let me slip in. I'm going to slip in. I think if he can join us, I've got a perfect window here. Neil Drysdale, and I asked Neil for just a quick hit. He's always down on the plaza at this time of morning. And he'll join us just for a couple of minutes. Neil Drysdale, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve.
Neil, obviously speaking for horse players, fans, everybody around the game, saddened by the news of Fupeg's passing.
Well, yeah, but he had a good run, and it wasn't like he had an accident. He died of age-related infirmities, you know.
Absolute 26.
So he had a good run, and I was a little bit surprised that he didn't do more as a stallion. I mean, he did have some very good horses scattered around the world, but and then I thought he'd make a very good broodmare stallion, but not as good as we thought, because he was such a brilliant horse. He had brilliance, and he had a lot of character and charisma. So we were all hoping that he would pass that on a bit.
You and I have talked before, and he was not an easy horse to, you know, to bring to the races and to manage.
No, the interesting thing about him was most horses like routine, and he didn't. He wanted to do something different every day.
Huh.
So you had to kind of outthink him a bit. But and then he would get quite rambunctious. If he didn't do enough, he would get very rambunctious and playful, and had some good tricks.
Well, and you, to be very fair, a horse like that in potentially in somebody else's hands might not have even been able to accomplish what he was able to accomplish. Because it feels like you were one step ahead of him. He really didn't have, during the prime of the 3-year-old run, he made it through nicely.
Yeah, and then he hurt his foot at the aqueduct. He caught his foot on the door, but it was an issue where the door at the bottom of the door was a bit rusted away, and he caught his foot on it. So then that's why we had to skip. We had to back off him there. After the Preakness, he did it while we were waiting for the Belmont. So then he had to go to the Fall, and he got a strange ride to win. Just trying to remember what he won prior to the Breeders' Cup.
The Jerome. You won the Jerome going a mile.
He won the Jerome, and he had a strange ride from the Zormo, but he still won going away. And then he had an even stranger ride from the Zormo in the Breeders' Cup. So there you go.
talk about the Derby and the run through and going to New York. What after the San Felipe, you chose the Wood. Talk about that path.
Well, in California, he wasn't. He was running in short fields, and so we felt that prior to the Kentucky Derby, that he should get used to a larger field of horses and get more experience. Plus, it's a good race to go into the Kentucky Derby off the wood. The spacing, the timing is very good. And it's more of a demanding track than what we have in California. So that was the thinking behind it. And of course, you know, the mile and a quarter race is a jump up in the woods, 9 furlongs. And so it's a good stepping stone.
It was also his first time on a wet track.
Correct. Yeah. So we just need to get used to a few things, you know, a larger field, a muddy track, dry. And well, it was kind of muddy. Yeah, it was a little bit muddy. But then in the Kentucky Derby, everything went very smoothly for him. The gods, the racing gods, smiled on him, opened up the paths. Gotta have that.
You got that going for you. For those, I'm sure some people watched yesterday. I mean, he came from well back. It needed a couple of seams here and there for Kent to find.
Yes, yeah, and he got them. But I think he won it. So he won the race very well. He ran it quite easily. He probably could have gone around the whole bloody lot, you know. So. Anyway, he gave us a great thrill. He was a very good looking horse, and super talent.
Neil, one question about Mr. Sekiguchi. How did you mesh in, and were you involved from the get go?
No, I wasn't. I stepped in. A little bit later, he was. I think the horse was in training in Florida, and they were having a little bit of trouble with him. So, the horse was moved to California.
Interesting. And you had him right from that point. You would had him from, you know, his first start.
I got him before. No, I got him as. A 2 year at the beginning of his 2 year old years,
right?
When I got him.
And he made the one start. He made the one start at Hollywood.
Yes,
he debuted to go in 6.5, and got beat.
That's all right.
Yes,
first time
exactly,
out.
Exactly. Then went on the nice string between the maiden win, allowance win, San Felipe, the Wood, and the Kentucky Derby, and then it looking back at Preakness, thoughts about what kind of a wide trip and...
A very wide trip.
Yeah.
A very wide trip. I said to Kent, you know, let's keep him out of trouble. But anyway, he went a lot further than any other horse and wasn't beaten that far.
No. And then, as mentioned, got hurt. The Jerome try win and the Breeders' Cup was. At what point was the decision made that he wasn't going to come back as a 4-year-old?
Well, he had been sold as a stallion during the summer.
Ah, so that was already in place.
So that was already done. Yeah, it was a done deal, you know, because he'd been sold for a lot of money.
Well, in the meantime, the Derby win, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Neil, he really, the excitement about him was really pronounced. I mean, the star power that he had, and I think a lot of people, he was like a favorite horse for a lot of people at that era.
Oh, no, it was fun. Sekiguchi made it, he put on a show, he brought the Geisha girls, and when the horse won, they they opened up their umbrellas and, you know, the said through Sanchi Pegasus and all that stuff. And, you know, from above, it was a scene from above when they opened up the umbrellas. I didn't even know it until later on.
I love it. Well, Neil, I appreciate the opportunity to pay tribute to him with you. And well done. It feels like.
Thank you. Anyway, it was a great run.
Neil Drysdale, everybody, and Fusaichi Pegasus. Thanks, Neil. Always, you know, the horsemen, you know, they're always stoic about it. 26, had a good long life. We're gonna stay because Satish is going to join us next, and so it's perfect that Neil was able to slip in there. Sets us up for a wider discussion of that night that Fupeg sells for $4 million. And it really felt like everything led to that because the first 2 days of the sale and then this third night. And he was, I've got it here, he was, in fact, as suggested. Let's see. Let me turn to the back page. That's not the back page. That's the middle. Hip. There we go. One was, well, where'd it go? All right. What did you do with it? It was hip 228. And there were three nights. So I've got the first two, and where's the third? There it is. There's the third night. Second to last hip through the ring, there was an RNA. There was a holy bull that RNA'd, a filly. But Fupeg was the second to last horse through the ring. Let's get Satish in here, and I think we're in for a treat. And it's too bad. Actually, it's too bad that word hadn't come yesterday because Sid could have addressed the stallion portion. I mean, for a son of Mr. Prospector, you know. That part of the equation. But Satish Sanan joins us as promised. Satish, good morning. Where is he?
Hey
Satish. We just talked to Neil Drysdale and he gave us the you know, the racing portion and his experience with Fusaichi Pegasus, but the tally sheet from the TDN of that third night of that sale, it absolutely tells an interesting story that you were, you know, at the center of, including that, you know, that last, virtually last hip through the ring and a chance to get Fupeg. And I absolutely wasn't going to miss a chance to have you talk about it.
Yeah, no, there were a lot of people involved. It wasn't just us. I think the story behind the story, a lot of people do not know. You know, those years were who's who in the sales arena. If you went to Keeneland or you went to Saratoga Sales, I mean, the biggest players, I think that was the only time those few years the biggest players were involved, from Darley to Sheikh Maham. Hamdan and Bob Lewis and Mr. Young from Overbrook and Bob McNair, you name it. They were the biggest players in the business. And, of course, you had a lot of very big stallions. But story behind Fupeg, we used to constantly compete with Coolmore, the best run, smartest organization, the best operators in the world, in my opinion. Very, 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 very smart operators. They wanted to buy because they had a lot of success in Europe with Danzig bloodlines. So if you look at the sales prior to that and during the sale, every Danzig, most likely a good horse, was acquired by Coolmore. And we used to compete. So we had an agreement on the number of horses we met before the sale. Where we were not going to bid against each other, it was a dancing. I was just that specific sire and the others. So we had exclusive rights to bid, I think, exchange rate was a dancing. We bought at that sale. There was the only exception. Demi and John Magner and the others made. And when it came to FUPAC, we had decided that we would jointly own it. We always wanted to own the horses together, but it never worked out. And Demi was going to bid on it, and he was. So, you know, I got off my seat. I was sitting in the middle with Lynn Lucas and went up there, and I was sitting right behind Demi, if you ever watched the video there. And I kept hacking him to keep going, but they pulled up at the 4 million was the limit. They pulled up. And if I was bidding on my own, I probably would have gone on. It was stupid in those days. So that's what it's all about. Ego comes in the way, you know. And so we lost it. But right after that, I went to Arthur Hancock, you know, called him in the morning and sent him an email. I said, I'd really like to own this horse and see if this guy would take $5 million. You know, offered him $1 million over the odds. And he said, no, he came here to acquire a few horses and, you know, he's not going to do that. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, 1 in 100 makes it. It's a very tough business. And he made it. Eventually, Coolmore acquired it. They paid $200 million for that horse at the start. So it's a long story, but that's how the deal went down. And he turned out to be a good stallion. But they know how to manage stallions. I mean, not, you know, they breed so many horses. And when you pay $200 million and you saw the stud fees, and they are the best. They're the masters of it. And shuttling to Australia and so on, they got their money's worth out of it. And I think the sire was reasonably successful. Not great sire. Not even this prospector. No. Stormcat, but if you look at the, you know, if you had a Stormcat, it went for a lot of price. You had a Mr. Prospector Colt, it was a lot of price. Because the very first yearling I ever bought was a Mr. Prospector yearling. I named him Sasha's Prospect. It was one of the first horses I bought, and a friend of mine bred him. Rich Santulli had bred him. It was Mr. Prospector out of Mrs. Mirage Colt, if I recall. And but he couldn't run a lick at $2.3 million and pay for that shit. But, those few years, we spent a lot of money. But, you know, it was fun. It's a great game. And you just have to be careful what you do in this business.
There's a couple of parts of this equation that came up with Neil. And it was not started with Neil Drysdale, and there is a real case to be made, I think, knowing what, you know, later on what they knew about him and the way Neil described, you know, his personality. There was no guarantee that he would have been as successful or even, you know, made a Derby winner under somebody else's care. And I suppose,
you know, he was a slow developing and you know, temperamental horse, and
yeah.
Neil has the patience of the Lord, and that's what you needed. The horse would have destroyed, would have got definitely destroyed under Baffert and Wayne Lucas, and, you know, those guys, the quarter horse trainers, they were great. They won a lot of races, but, you know, they push horses to the limit at a very young age, and Neil gave him the time and developed him, and eventually he came into being what he was bred to be, and you know, it was worth it. So it's just horses for trainers and trainers for horses. I mean, it works.
Yep.
You know, but
this particular, well, I want you to talk a little bit, because this night and these three nights, July 19th, 20th, 21st, and this Keeneland yearling sale of 1998, and in particular that third night, because it literally, Satish, in what had to be the last 45 minutes to an hour of the sale, you got exchange rate and cash run five hips apart.
Yeah, we I think in the overall July sales, we bought over 20 horses, well over $1 million. We spent close to either $34 or $38 million in the July sale. But some of them paid, you know, I mean, the cash run we bought, and we won the Breeders' Cup with it. But then when we sold it, I sold half of it. That's another story for another day, but I sold half of it to Coolmore. And then we had a falling apart relationship way back. And we were forced to put it into the sale, and we did. And I was the underbidder to John Magner at $6.9 million, and he bought it for $7 million. And, you know, that's the story on cash run. So we made money. We made money on exchange rate, became a great sire. But we also bought Colonial Boy, I think $2.2 million we paid, and it was the shit. So, you know, when you look at it, we bought a lot of horses in that race. Very few actually make it. And, you know, if you buy yearlings, the return on investment is not that great. That's one lesson. I think, you know, big players like me and who are successful business people come into the game and they think we're going to, all these dummies, you know, we think they're dummies, they don't know. They're bloody 10 times smarter than we were. So, I mean, competing with the best organization in the world, you know, Magner and Coolmore and those guys, like swimming with the sharks, you know, you can't win, you can't beat the game. And I thought, you know, we could. But there were some great players. Bob Lewis had a lot of success, and, you know, but it's tough when you buy yearlings. You're lucky if, you know, 10% of those end up being stakes horses and make money. My biggest success, if you look at it, I spent probably $150 million in thoroughbred racing, including farms and so on, and probably $100 million in buying horses. I, you know, with all the fucking team that I had and the people that I had and all the shit that we used to go through from confirmation and heart measurements and, you know, how much oxygen they can breathe to all kinds of things. And the best trainers and the best know-how, the success rate was still very low. But the biggest success that came was really the horses, three or four horses I bought off the track directly. Nobody, my team wasn't involved. You know, I bought Any Given Saturday in 10 minutes in a paddock in Tampa. We sold it for $40 million to, for it was a partnership with Winstar. It was a great partnership.
Yep.
We sold it for $40 million. I bought Curlin when I was in a plane in London and off to India, and I told Sasha to buy Curlin. And then John Moynihan got involved in Stone Street, but we ended up owning a piece of it and sold for a lot of money. And I think very few off the track. I bought Face the Cat. I think he ran a couple of races and won some stakes races, but nothing great. A few others. So I think if I look at those, versus the big success from the sales, you know, the cash on the exchange rate, the Yes Is True, the Vindication was a big success.
Sure.
Syndicated it for $26 million. I think as a ratio, it's return on investment from yearlings is low. So anybody coming in new, don't underestimate the big players. Go slow, learn the business. Really, I hired some dumb people I didn't know. I thought I was too smart. I was going to outsmart all these people. You can't outsmart the people who've been in the business for hundreds of years and families and so on. Hired somebody really honest who's not going to cheat, because everybody's a cheater in this business. So you got to hire and pay them well so they don't have the tendency to cheat. I used to give them, you know, I gave them not only the normal commission, 5%, but I gave them plus 5% ownership in the horses. So, but in spite of all that, they would still go out and cheat. And I would say that you don't just focus on yearlings because the cost is less, but you have then a 2-year cost of breaking and training. And you know, if you buy 100, maybe 20 are going to make it to the racetrack, or 30 are going to make it to the racetrack. This, the attrition is very high. You know, I was stupid. I paid, I think, $4.2 million for a 10-month-old weanling in Tattersall. Half brother to, you know, Irish Derby winner and Epsom Derby winner and great pedigree, and the horse, I could run faster than the dog, you know, so it didn't work out. Too much risk at that level. So I think a mix where you buy a few yearlings, and particularly fillies, I would focus on that, because it's a good pedigree, good thing, they may not be able to run, but you have a residual value. I would buy maybe a few already broken 2-year sales, but the return on investment, you pay more, but you get a much bigger investment if you're able to buy a young, early on, a good colt, if you're particularly looking for a colt, because that's the only place where the value is. If they become a stallion, that's the only way to make money in this business, otherwise there is no money. And that's how Coolmore has been successful. They're the best and the greatest at it, all over the world, Australia, Europe.
Satish, if you took the key learning that you're expressing, and you know, obviously the market, I mean, the market has changed somewhat, but not, you know, not entirely. The basic framework is still in place, and a lot of what you're referencing, you know, the groups that are specifically, you know, looking to create stallions, that, you know, that's a pronounced approach. Then you've got some outfits that are taking less resistance by looking at turf horses. That's become, you know, for those that aren't going after, you know, Derby glory. Then there's an outfit like Eclipse that is very filly centric in terms of residual value. How many did you ever get involved with 2-year-olds in training, or did you shy away from that?
No, we used to. We used to go to all the time to 2-year-old sales, Calder and other places in Keeneland. We bought some. We all call out 2-year-old sales. I can't honestly remember that we bought many, but the biggest story in the 2-year-old sales, we had a yearling that we sold for $400,000, we didn't think was worth much as a yearling, so we used to take some and sell it in the latter part of our business. And that horse ended up setting the world record. Coolmore bought it for $16 million. It was the Green Monkey, so that was a goddamn bust when you think about it. I sold it for $400,000, so I looked stupid, you know. I should have kept it. this game will make fools out of it.
But, well, know, at least you didn't pay the 16. I mean, there's plenty of people who claim that the 16 never really changed hands.
There was a bot before the sale, and it was run up. That's the dark side of the business that you don't really want to get into. But I learned the hard way. But that's just what happens. You know, 2-year-old, the horses get bought and then they get put in. And when the big players, there was a battle. It was a setup battle between Sheikh Mohammed and John Magnet and the team. And then if they think that they're going to beat the Belly Doyle boys on that business, they're stupid. They're not going to, nobody's going to beat them. They're smartest operators. I have so much respect.
You know, I said when you were going to be on, and when I kind of thumbnailed some of the, I mean, this sale was an amazingly productive 3 nights as yearling sales go.
I think because we, again, a statistician, we don't forget, we bought 20 horses in a row those nights and paid over $1 million. So if you buy that kind of pedigree, that kind of horses, you spend that kind of money, you're going to get some success. But it was a very productive exchange. It was a big scallion. We made millions of dollars. Cash run, you know, Breeders' Cup winner, and we sold it twice. First time for $3-some million, win 50%, and the second time we ended it up to 7s, even though I was bidding on 50 cents on a dollar at that time. But John had made up his mind that he was going to own that mare, and you know, he owned it. And, you know, it was a good relationship with John and the team. And but, you know, they pivoted afterwards from the U.S. to focus more on turf races, which they do. And they're phenomenally successful, and their children are phenomenally successful now in Europe. And they buy the best, they have the best people, the best management, the best trainers, the best track records, and, you know, from Winston O'Brien's to Adrian O'Brien's to you name it. I mean, it's, nobody else has done it, you know.
You know, Satish, I mean, when we think about Curlin and any given Saturday, you know, even with exchange rate, you know, but there's been a lot of other residual success. And whenever we see the name, I always point it out to people. And you could just look at Charlatan, for instance. Authenticity, right? Authenticity was one of your great successes on the Philly side.
There were many. We won this Kyleville. We won, you know, Dance Master, Cash Run. Yes, it's true. You know, we had 8 stallions in Florida. I mean, they weren't paying much, 10,000, 8,000. But, you know, but when you spend that kind of money, I mean, I was in the game, I think, 10, 12 years from 1996 to 2007. And, you know, not many people can say that the number of races we won, number of Breeders' Cup we won, number of Eclipse War we won. We won more in 7 years than people in 50, 60, 100 years. But took a lot of effort and a lot of courage. And, you know, you got to have big balls to go against those boys and those businesses, you know. But, you know, it was fun. But a lot of mistakes, Steve.
What single piece of advice do you use for people that are, you know, that are just starting out and
you know? Well, it all depends. If you're starting out, and you know, it depends what is your balance sheet looks like, and what is your motive. I mean, if you just want to get started out and you want to have fun and just go to the races, or do you have a balance sheet that, you know, you don't mind throwing $100 million at it and establishing a long-term sustainable business model, which is, I wanted to do both, have fun, gamble, and have a business. But I think the last thing wasn't sustainable at the rate we were spending. So if a small guy who wants to just have fun, then I would say that the easiest and the best way is to go to a track and buy a proven product. And because they're going to run, you're going to come for second, third, you're going to win some money, you're at the races and have a businessman who wants to do this both for fun and as a business and have a lot of enjoyment. Then I think all of us, because we have the ego and we build businesses, we're fucking on it. We think we can come in. I mean, we do. We think we can. I was one of those. We think we can come in and conquer the world. That world is nobody's conquered, you know? I mean, you look at it. And I would say take it slow. Hire an expert and honest people and learn the business before you dive in. I just dived in the deep end without knowing I could even goddamn swim, you know. I mean, honestly, I went to the first sales team there. I had hired a guy from a university professor who thought I knew about the horses, and went there and spent $14 million. The first day I was in the Keeneland, and I was wearing jeans and a T-shirt, and they won't even let me in the pavilion to bid on it. Of course, I bought goddamn Mr. Prospector Colt and a few other Colts, and, you know, $14 million later, so I had the front seat, and, you know. And I didn't know what you do with it early after you bought it. I had no idea, you know, where to send it, what to do. I had to ask somebody, and ended up consulting Will Farish at Lane's End, and he came in the next morning, looked at my horses, and took them and sent to South Carolina to one of his training centers. I remember flying up there, and it was a piece of shit, so I said, I'm not going to spend $14 million and keep it there. So I ended up buying a farm. I spent $20, $30 million on the goddamn farm in the car. So that's the ego, right? You don't need that crap.
No.
So I learned the hard way. And I'm saying, don't do any of those stupid things that I did.
Well, you also won a hatful of Breeders' Cup races, and you know, it is funny, because I said early in the show, you know, we were looking forward to this conversation, and we've had bits and pieces of it when we had our industry conversations with you for years, but a lot of people probably haven't heard, you know, these elements. But it was amazing, because you were one of the people, like so many others, Gary West and Kaleem Shah and Amer Zidan, and you know, people that want to win a Derby, and he ended up winning all kinds of good things, and you know,
we won everything except the Derby.
Yeah, exactly.
We had five runners in the Derby. We had Curlin. We had Any Given Saturday. We had
Exchange Rate.
Exchange Rate. We had Horse Finish Last. A red horse, I forget his name, he won the Lexington, and it was a slop. But we never, you know, third, fifth, 14th, last, never won that race. But we won everything else. We
yeah.
Won big races. I mean, you name it, we won it. We won the Haskell. We beat Curling, beat Any Given Saturday, beat Curling in that race. And, you know, we won the Preakness with Curling. And,
yeah.
So I won everything. I won, you know, 4 or 5 Breeders' Cups and 4 or 5 Eclipse Awards, the Horse of the Year. There's not too many people who can put that kind of record up there and say, but I'm going to tell you that it was at a huge cost and a lot of stupid mistakes that people should make, even if they have a lot of money. But there's a lot of people who came into the business. I forgot the name of the Cuban guy who was from Miami and came in, and Royal Delta was his horse, one of them.
Sure. Leon. Bessie Lou.
Yeah. And I mean, built a farm identical to mine up there and spent a lot of money. But he went, and Kaleem Shah came in, and he had a lot of success with Baffert. And then he still might be in the business. And
yeah.
Gary is a good friend. I talked to Gary. They're going to quit the business, but he's still in the business. You know, Gary and Mary West, I mean, they, you know, a lot of money, a lot of wealth, very savvy business people. They don't have children, and it's their enjoyment. They have a very good program. They manage it well. They've gone through a lot of trainers, like I did. But Steve, it's not an easy game. It's
no.
not an easy business.
No.
You know, it's not for the faint-hearted. Let's put it this way.
That's for sure.
If you don't have the heart and the balls, don't go into this business, period. You know.
No, good advice. Good advice. But in the end, you know, I know they're just trophies, and but they're memories. Your kids grew up around the racetrack, and I mean, ultimately, it's been satisfying, has it not?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of enjoyment. But it was a financial disaster, you know. And if I was in the same situation financially and what I wanted to do, would I do it again? Yes, but I would do it the Bob Lewis way. He was very, very sharp and smart. Never owned a farm, never owned anything. He just outsourced and had a lot of success. You know, there's a story with a story. Wayne used to train for him, and he was an exclusive trainer for me. People didn't know that early on. And one day he calls me up. He used to call me every night, and he calls me up, and he said, you know, Bob wants to sell a group of horses, and I picked 4 for you. I said, you know, which one? And he named 4 horses. And I said, how much does he want? They're like $400,000. And I said, okay, let's look at it. And one of them was Charismatic, $85,000. This is before he won the Derby in Northern California.
Yeah, the Golden Gate. Yeah, El Camino.
And it was $85,000. So, you know, my kids and family was involved, you know. So we discussed it. And my wife says, we don't want anybody's cast off horses and so on. Shit, we could have bought that for $85,000. The fucking horse goes to win the Derby. Sells it to the Japanese for $25 million. So there's the story, you know. It's a stupid decision, right?
I've never, you've never told me that story.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories.
There's a lot of buffers. Oh, my God. That's unbelievable. I didn't know this.
Yeah, it's true. It's true story.
You're amazing.
If Wayne is still training, you can ask him.
There's an issue on that front. that dates you and me dates back 10, 12 years. Satish, this is a little bit more bittersweet than I was expecting, but because I can tell, you know, you're reflecting on, you know, the food peg, and I'm sure looking at the, I sent you that sale tally, the tally sheet.
Yeah, I mean, I really, because again, I think integrity is very important in business. You shake hands, you do business and shake hands, and that's what we did with Coolmore, and we were partners for a period of time. But I never owned a horse together. You know, I competed and bid against them when I bought the half brother to the Irish Derby winner. We named him goddamn Pagio's Pride. And I tell you, I could run faster than him. He never ran on $4.2 million, you know. So we, you know, I was bidding against Demi. I mean, we got into wars with them and Sheikh Mohammed. I bought Mare, I paid $4.2 million at Tattersall. It was a proven Mare. Dermot well trained it and so on. So I think, you know, I mean, if you can't learn lessons from those kind of things, if anybody's going, you know, I'm happy to give my personal advice free. Advice is free.
And, but the experience is priceless.
It is. I mean, you know, but, you know, overall, it's a chapter, a very important chapter in my family's history. I think we had a lot of fun. I mean, shit, you used to see us. I remember in one day, I flew through three different tracks. I won the Devona Dale, I think, with Cash Run, I'm going to say, in another race. Then I flew and I won the Risen Star with Exchange Rate. And then we flew to Arkansas and we won something there. I mean, we won the Arkansas Derby. We won, you know, that was with Curlin later on. But, you know, I'd get on a goddamn plane just for one race and go from here to Hollywood, you know, California. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of excitement. You know, you have to manage the financial aspects of the business.
Well, the game, as we've said many times, the game certainly was better off with your involvement, and you contributed, you attempted to contribute in so many different ways we think back to, you know, what happened in 2010 and what might have been, frankly, the industry-wide plan you tried to execute and came so close.
Well, I was warned if I came back, they were going to kill me when I launched the air program, the airlines or industry to form. You remember that shit, you know.
Yep. Yeah,
but this is the game is controlled, the game is managed, and there's a lot of big players. And those guys are all still around, generations. And it's a bit of a closed society. And you just have to be very, very careful and very smart. So there's things you can talk about on the radio. I mean, I'm not afraid of anybody. You know me. I mean, I say anything I want to say. But there are things that one shouldn't, because that's one other lesson that I pissed off a lot of people in that business. I should have been quiet, you know.
Well, yeah, you also opened plenty of eyes and helped plenty of people. You know, the people that you're still friends with, they all treasure your friendship and counsel.
Well, it's you've been there, and you keep up the great work that you're doing. I tell you, somebody I used to call, what's his name? He used to be the editor at Blood Horse. He came and stayed at my farm.
Ray Pollock.
Yeah, Ray Pollock, you know, and unfortunately, you know, things happened, and you know, somebody has to be the conscience of the industry, and we've been endeavored to do that. Industry is great business.
Satish Sanan, and all time spent with Satish is valuable. Satish, thank you for this.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Satish Sanan, Padua Stables, everybody, and using Fupeg as the linchpin to the discussion. And I did not know about Charismatic. He never has told that story. maybe because he didn't want to throw Ann under the bus, I guess. That's unbelievable. Well, and of course, you know, they ran Charismatic for 62.5. So 85,000 was a reasonable price point. Unbelievable. And he mentioned, you know, it's funny, he mentioned Bob and Beverly Lewis, and they bought Commendable in this sale. I want to say for 400? I think 400. In that same sale. Crazy. Forest Camp came out of this sale. Solvig was in this sale early. HIP 21. So they actually, Satish bought the HIP 1 too out of this sale. World Net, they named him. 700,000. So they started with a bang and almost ended with a bang. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And there we go. Commendable. 575, excuse me. 575. Frequently referred to as in certain discussions about the Belmont Stakes. Commendable. Let's take a break. Only one of the morning. We got tons to do. Chris Mers is going to join us. I got to get to Tom Law. We've got the Thorograph, the Win with Thorograph conversation with Jeff Franklin in the next hour. And Seth and Rich. So we got lots to do yet. I hope you enjoyed that. I mean, I treasure every conversation with him. He's one of a kind, an amazing guy. Has made fortunes 2-3 times. You got a very frank look at the business with Satish there. Back after this, second half at the races. Stay with us.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place.
Heading on. How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo.